Well, I want to say hi to everybody in this room, folks at all of our campuses, people joining us online from all around the world. So glad you're here. Before I get into the message, we're going to take a moment to celebrate what God did last weekend at Easter. I'll tell you one story. Our San Mateo campus, a woman came, never been to our church before. She said to one of the greeters, I loathe churches and I loathe Christians, but I'm spiritual and it's Easter, so I feel like I ought to go someplace. Didn't believe the Bible. Sat through the service, and the first line of the first song, she said later, she felt like God was speaking directly to her. Not only did she stay through the whole service, but God spoke to her so deeply, she ended up committing her life, and she got baptized at the service. So that was, like, amazing. I want to let you know, some of you have been around for a while, you've been a part of when we launched sites years ago. We really didn't know. We were praying, God, what might you do? We had so much to learn. So, again, if you're part of the family, just for you to have a little update, last weekend at the Mountain View campus, we had over 1,600 people there. At San Mateo, over 1,300 people jammed into that place. At San Jose, that just got started a year ago, over 700 people. And stuff was rocking at the cafe, the spirit in here, the celebration, the way that you guys celebrated for folks that made their baptism commitment, that was so cool. All together, we had very near 10,000 people at our church last weekend, and well over 100 folks that got baptized or reaffirmed their baptism. So I just wanted to say, yay, God, yay, you, way to go, way to pray and serve and give, and thank God. I believe doors are opening for us right now. You'll be hearing more about this, but I think we're just at the beginning of the greatest season God's ever had for our church. Now, we're launching a new series, and I'll start. I was reading last week about a question. What do you think is the number one thing that a woman is looking for in a man? What do you think is number one? Money is, that came up a couple of times. No, actually, that's not the number one thing, but given where we live, not a surprising answer. At least according to what I read last week, it's actually confidence. It's confidence. You think about that. You know, when somebody is living with authentic confidence, when they look you right in the eye when they're talking with you, when they have this conviction that whatever life throws at them, they can handle, that they're willing to take risks, they're willing to run challenges. When they talk to you, you don't have to guess what they really think. They just speak the truth, but they do it in a gracious way. Right now, guys, if this is you, you're sitting straight up, your shoulders are back, your head is high, you're ready for life. Who doesn't want to be around that? And on the other hand, when somebody's living where their confidence has gotten beaten out of them, when the evil one whispers to you, you can't do this, you can't make it, you don't have what it takes, it makes you less joyful, it actually makes you less generous, it kind of robs life out of you, it makes everything harder. It's harder to do a job interview, it's harder to ask somebody out for a date, harder to make a basket, harder to perform well at work. You ever see somebody where they're going to give a talk and they're just like all flop, sweat, and panicky, harder to give a talk? And so a natural question is, where can I get confidence? Because we'd all rather live with confidence. And I was thinking this week, maybe the guy who has more grounds for confidence, humanly speaking, than anybody else, would be this guy right here. Tom Brady. Anybody know Tom Brady? Wow. And it's a woman clapping her hands, so no big surprise there. Because he's just ridiculously good looking, great hair, toothy smile, amazingly talented. He's a winner. He's won 4 Super Bowls. He's married to a supermodel, for crying out loud. He's famous all around the world. He's got a gazillion dollars. So, humanly speaking, if you want to live always confident, guys, just be born Tom Brady. Just be born with incredible athletic ability and amazing leadership gifts and be real popular and win 4 Super Bowl rings and marry a supermodel and have great hair and great teeth and be a world-famous gazillionaire. And if you're a woman right now and you're sitting next to a man and he looks, you know, a little crestfallen, just reach over and pat him on the arm and whisper to him, too late. But there is another way if you're kind of interested in confidence. No, don't actually do that. That's a joke. There is another way. Another real different guy, the Apostle Paul, made what I submit might be the most staggering claim about confident living that's ever been spoken by a member of the human race. And this is what Paul said. Think about this. Writes to the church at Corinth. Therefore, we are always confident. Now, Paul didn't just throw words around loosely. You think about what would it mean every day, good day, bad day, good mood, bad mood, difficult task, hard circumstances, to be always confident. And here's the thing about Paul. He was no Tom Brady. We don't know for sure what he looked like, but the oldest description of Paul is he was short, bald, and had a hooked nose. He didn't have a lot of money. He had no money. He wasn't famous, kind of infamous. He was in prison. Wasn't married to a supermodel or a trophy wife. He wasn't married at all. Here's the thing about Paul. He was confident, but he was not self-confident. This gets us into this, the confidence paradox. We all, it's a natural human thing. We'd love to face life with confidence, especially where we live in the Bay Area. To believe in yourself, to be confident in yourself, that's the Holy Grail. With Paul, he had enormous confidence, but it wasn't in him, it was in God. God had put his spirit in Paul. Paul says, therefore, that's why I'm always confident. And here's the confidence paradox. Paul actually put it like this. When I am weak, then I am strong. How weird is that? When I'm weak, really? This really gets into profound dynamics about human life. A guy by the name of Andy Crouch has written a wonderful little book, and it's called Strong and Weak. And Andy talks about how we tend to think of weakness and strength as this continuum where you've either got one or the other. He uses the words vulnerability. You're either vulnerable or you have authority. And a lot of us think, man, we would just like to have more authority, more money, more education or so. Some people are more comfortable actually being vulnerable. But we think of it as a single continuum. Andy says, actually, you ought to think about this as two continuums, two dynamics. You can be high or low in authority, and you can be high or low in vulnerability. And when you look at the Bible, it's very interesting because it says God made us to have an enormous amount of authority. When God created human beings, it says he made us in his image. God actually said to human beings, I want you to exercise dominion. I want you to reign for good, powerfully, over the earth like a queen, like a king. Real high in authority. But then when it comes to vulnerability, he also made human beings very vulnerable. The text says that both Adam and his wife were naked, and they felt no shame. Now, naked is a word about vulnerability. We'll say in our day, if I feel really vulnerable, I felt naked, I felt so exposed. And part of what's so interesting about this word is only human beings can be naked. You ever think about that? Where we live, sometimes people will dress their cats or dogs up in little dresses or sweaters. You ever notice that? But when they don't have their sweater on, you don't say, hey, look at that naked cat. Because animals can't be naked. Only people can be naked. And kids notice this, and that's why they love to make jokes about naked animals. There's an old one you will have all heard. Why is it that you never see two elephants swimming together? Because they only have one pair of trunks? I feel a little naked right now, actually. A little vulnerable here in this room. But God made us to be high in authority, but also high in vulnerability. When the greatest human being who ever lived, Jesus, came, he was super high in authority. He actually said, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. But at the same time, he was the most vulnerable human being that ever lived. And the Bible says that he humbled himself, took on the form of a servant, and became obedient to death, even death on a cross, the humiliating death of a slave. People saw in Jesus more authority than they had ever seen, and they saw vulnerability like it had never seen. And see, he was revealing to us something very deep about the human condition. Brilliant little book. And he says that if you think about it as a two-by-two graph, it basically describes the different modes of life that we can enter into. If somebody has a lot of authority, but they feel like they're invulnerable, that moves them into being exploiting or oppressive. Bullies do this. Tyrants do this. We read about this every day in our world. Now, if somebody has no authority, but they also don't want to experience any vulnerability, then they will withdraw, just try to live in bubble wrap. A lot of people live here. If somebody has very little authority, very little power, little education, resources, but they're extremely vulnerable, then they suffer. But if we experience great authority and great vulnerability, we live in the dignity and worth of image bearers of God, but we're transparent with each other. We're vulnerable with each other. We're dependent on God, not ourselves. We're humble. Then human beings, then human community can flourish. So that's what we're going to be looking at. Man, this series is so needed, I believe, all over the world, but especially in the Bay Area today, where everybody wants to have a lot of authority, but nobody wants to be vulnerable. And we're going to go after this by looking at this character in the Bible who wrestled a lot with confidence and authority and vulnerability. Fascinating guy by the name of Jacob. And we're going to roll up our sleeves today, but we're going to go on this journey with him for some weeks. It's going to be really, really, I think, fun and potentially life-changing. His struggle begins even before he's born. Kind of a fun beginning to his story. His mom and dad are Isaac and Rebekah, and they're married for 20 years. They're not able to have children. In the ancient world, that's an even bigger deal than it is in our world. And so Isaac prayed for 20 years for his wife, and finally God moves. She's pregnant, but her pregnancy is so painful, she doesn't think she can stand it. Here's where the story starts. When her time to give birth came, sure enough, there were twins in her womb. The first came out reddish, as if snugly wrapped in a hairy blanket. That sounds like a cute little kid, doesn't it? They named him Esau, which actually literally meant hairy. His brother followed, his fist clenched tight to Esau's heel. They named him Jacob, which could mean the grabber or the deceiver. And the idea here is that his story begins even in the womb, that way back in the womb, little fetal Jacob looks at little fetal Esau and says, he's closer to the exit than me. He's going to get out first. That'll make him the firstborn. That means he'll be the heir. He'll get the birthright. He'll get the blessing. He'll get the land and all the money. He'll be dad's favorite and I won't. He'll be number one and I'll always be number two. And I can't trust mom or the universe or the uterus or whatever's in charge out there to take care of me, so I got to look after myself. So I will grab my brother's heel and yank him back at the last minute, and I'll get out of the womb, and then I'll be number one. I'll be the firstborn. But his plan doesn't work. All this travail inside Rachel, but he doesn't get out first. Inside Rebecca, he doesn't get out first. He fails. He's a little fetal failure. And that's going to haunt him his whole life long until it saves him. So they're born. The text goes on. The boys grew up. Esau became an expert hunter and outdoorsman. Jacob was a quiet man, preferring life indoors among the teens. Esau, he's got it, man. He's like Tom Brady with hair, with fur. Jacob has got a lot less testosterone. And then their parents come into play. And we're told Isaac, the dad, loved Esau because he loved his game. Esau's a hunter. Isaac just loved the food that Esau would bring him. People are such mixed bags. You got to know this about the Bible. Somebody's asking, you know, why is God gracious to Jacob in this story when he gets so much stuff wrong? The Bible is not a story about, you know, examples of character virtues. It's a story about God working with real, ordinary, mixed up people like you and me. And people who don't understand this, they flatten out the Bible. They never get it. Isaac, on the one hand, is so devoted to God that he prays for 20 years for God to make his wife pregnant. He's so shallow that he plays favorites with his own sons, and he loves Esau for this reason, because he likes the food that Esau brings him. Might as well have named him Little Cinnabon. That's why he loves him best. But Rebecca loved Jacob. Why does Rebecca love Jacob the most? Again, the Bible is so fascinating, it doesn't tell us. Got to fill in the blanks. Maybe it's because she felt sorry for him. Maybe it's because he was an indoor kid, so he was with her more. Maybe it's because she got problems with Isaac, and this is a way of getting back at him. But for whatever reason, she loved Jacob, but not Isaac. And as Jacob grew up, see, his identity became, I'm not Esau. Esau's the strong one. Esau's the hunter. Esau's my dad's favorite. And yourself is so exquisitely sensitive to rejection, to not being loved. And this is Jacob's identity. I am the one my father doesn't love. And man, that'll wound you right to the core. And everybody knows that feeling one way or another. I'm the one my mother does not love. I'm the one my husband does not love. I'm the one my wife does not love, breaks my heart. I'm the one my daughter does not love. I'm the one my son does not love. And we can't bear that. And then all this stuff happens inside us. We think, you know, if only I was Esau, if only I had Esau's body or Esau's wealth or Esau's gifts or Esau's personality, but you carry this wound, this scar, this gift. You weren't made to be Esau. You're just made to be you. And if God is ever going to bless you, it'll have to be you right there in your life, your body, your circumstance, your age, your situation. That's the only place where God can bless you. And Jacob just thinks, man, if I was only Esau. And there's this struggle between them and who's going to get the birthright, who's going to get the blessing, you know, all through their life. And then when Isaac's an old man, his senses are failing, he's quite feeble, and he thinks he might be dying, he says to Esau, the favorite, go kill an animal and make some stew like I love, and I'll eat it, and then I'll give you the blessing. Now, Rebecca, the mom, hears this, so she gets her son Jacob, her favorite, and she tells him what's going on, and she says, I'll make some stew real fast before Esau can get back, and you go into your dad, and you pretend to be Esau, and you get the blessing, you get the good stuff, you grab it. Jacob responds to his mom, Rebecca, but my brother Esau is a hairy man while I have smooth skin. What if my father touches me? I would appear to be tricking him. He wouldn't just appear to, he'd be tricking him and would bring down a curse on myself rather than a blessing. He's not concerned about the ethics of this. He just didn't want to get in trouble. I don't want to have a curse. And so Rebecca's response is so interesting. His mother said to him, let the curse fall on me. Just do what I say. Now, this tells us something about Rebecca. If we go back to those four quadrants, Rebecca has a very high sense of authority, but she doesn't feel vulnerable at all. She's in this quadrant right here. They lived in a patriarchal world. Isaac's the dad. He's the one that's supposed to be in charge, but the wife, the woman, actually has a stronger personality. She actually has a more forceful will. Does that ever actually happen in marriages? And it does in this one, man. So her response to Jacob is, oh, yeah, I'm real worried about your dad. He really scares me. Let the curse fall on me. And she'll use her authority and her invulnerability to exploit Isaac, her husband, and Esau, her son. And she says to Jacob, you know, you just do what I tell you to do. See, so we're going to talk about this quadrant now, quadrant number four. Because this is where oppression and exploitation happens. This is the lure, see, guys. This is what where we live right here is the promise. You can have all authority, but no vulnerability. Well, who wouldn't want that? And you experience that temptation all the time. You come into a room like this. We all will have felt this. And there's hundreds of people gathered together. Now, for a lot of people, that's kind of a threatening thing. For some, you know, we have that moment when we greet each other. And if you're introverted, you hate that moment. You'd stay till after that moment's over if you could. For extroverts, you love, there's a few among us, you're ultra extroverted, and you love that moment. What's going on in your mind is hundreds of new friends, and they all get to meet me today. How fabulous is that? How lucky for them, how much I'm going to enjoy this. You know who you are. We all know who you are. The rest of us do, and we think you're truly bizarre. But what if you go away and there's a party, you're going to school or something like that, and you feel like a stranger, you feel like an outsider? What if somebody invented a beverage, something that you could put in a glass and you could drink from that glass while you were walking around, and it made your discomfort just magically melt away? What if there was a kind of liquid that you could just drink it, and it would make your sense of vulnerability diminish and your sense of confidence enhance? What if there was a beverage like that? Wouldn't somebody make $1 million selling a beverage like that? There actually is. We don't serve it here, so don't look so excited, but there actually is. And see, when you use alcohol to manage your vulnerability, you're going into quadrant four. It's exactly what you're doing. You're going to have more authority without vulnerability. But the irony is you keep doing that enough, and eventually what happens is it requires more and more of that stuff, and the feeling grows smaller and smaller, and eventually, if you get hooked on it enough, you end up down here in quadrant two where you're robbed of all authority. Authority, Andy says, is the capacity for meaningful action. That's authority, the capacity for meaningful action. And eventually, you get addicted to anything. Your ability to keep your word, to maintain your relationships, to be your best self, all gets eroded. And your vulnerability goes up. You can't live without it. And you end up with intense suffering. See, this is sin. This is temptation. This goes back to the beginning of the Bible in the book of Genesis. If you're a Bible person, you may know this story. Serpent comes to the woman, to Eve, and his comment to her was, if you'll trust me, if you'll disconnect from God, you will be like God. That means you'll have high authority. and you will surely not die. You will have no vulnerability. And she listens to him, and she defies God. And, of course, what actually happens is absolutely the opposite of that. See, temptation, sin, promises all authority and no vulnerability, but ultimately it gives you all vulnerability and no authority. So she says to Jacob, you know, come on over to my quadrant. You can pretend, you can put on Esau's clothes and smell just like him. We'll put a goat skin on you so you'll be here and you'll feel just like him and you can talk like him and act like him. And Jacob goes into his dad. It's like a scene in a movie. It's amazing drama. He went to his father and said, now think about what's going on in his heart in that moment, and said, my father. Yes, Isaac said. Isaac's very feeble now, his senses are failing. Which son is it? Jacob answered his father, I am Esau. And then a world of emotion in this next phrase, as if he wasn't sure which Esau it was. I am Esau, your firstborn. Son number one. The one you love. And it works. And he fools his dad. And Jacob learns this little lesson that if you cannot get what you want by being who you really are, maybe you can get it by pretending to be who you are not. Maybe if you can't get it by being Jacob, you can get it by trying to be Esau. And I was thinking, where we live, and even in the church, how often we just pretend. We just pretend to be and think and believe and so who we're not. I grew up as a church kid, and I just got good at pretending. I'd pretend with my parents when I was real little to be smarter than I really was and happier than I really was and more popular at school than I really was. I'd pretend as I was growing up that I didn't want to drink because I'm really devoted to God and I wouldn't want to do something like that, when the reality is actually I kind of really did, but I didn't want to get caught. I was afraid of getting caught. I didn't date very much in school, and so when I was growing up with my parents, I would kind of pretend like I'm kind of above that. I'm kind of really into studies and really into sports and stuff like that, and I'm not really into girls, but in my head, I was really in my head, like I was desperate to date a cute girl. I'd have sold my grandmother to date a cute girl, and I love my grandmother, and I just learn over time. I'd pretend to agree with people that I don't agree with. And so who is this person? Why would I do that? Why would I try to be somebody I'm not? Because I think if I'm just me, if I show up with just me, I can't get the good stuff. And see, when Jesus came, all authority and all vulnerability, he had this amazing dynamic where people would just be themselves and they'd stop pretending. And tax collectors and Gentiles and prostitutes and lepers. This little community where people just take off masks. And he hated it when people pretended. He actually went after it. He called it hypocrisy. He actually coined hypocrisy as we use that word. Jesus was the first one to use it in that way because he hated it when people would use faith or God or religion to make other people pretend to be better than they are, to be somebody that they're not. Guys, for us to be a community where you can just come in and be real, that's the only way to actually have true confidence. So Jacob doesn't do it. What happens to Jacob is he ends up in this quadrant down here. His brother Esau says, I'm going to kill him. Rebecca hears about that, and she says to Jacob, you know, Esau's the hunter. You don't stand a chance against him. So he runs away from home, 40 years old. Lost everything. In the Bible, in Genesis, anytime somebody goes on a journey like that, there'll be a village. Hospitality is a big deal in the ancient world. Some people would come and offer hospitality. Not Jacob. Jacob is all by himself, sleeping alone in the wilderness. Rocks around his head to protect him in case a wild animal comes. Why? Because he is now at his maximum vulnerability, and then it happens. And he has this vision. And he sees this ladder. There's a song, Jacob's Ladder. We're climbing Jacob's ladder, but in this story, Jacob's not climbing up to God. Heaven is coming down to Jacob. The angels of God. And there above it stood the Lord. And he said, I am the Lord. Only time this title is used in all the Bible, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. Now, of course, Isaac was Jacob's real dad, so why didn't God say, I'm the God of your father Isaac? Well, Isaac was Esau's dad. Isaac was the father who loved Esau. Jacob was not Esau. And I think God is kind of saying, I know. I care. I'll be your father. I will heal you if you let me. And Jacob has his first spiritual awakening. Doesn't solve all of his problems. He's got a lot of mess to go through in this story, but what he says is, surely God is in this place, and I was not aware of it. God was right here. He says, he gives it a name. He says, this is Bethel, the house of God. Surely this is the gate of heaven. God has come to me, little Jacob, son number two, the deceiver, the grabber. I could trust God. God could be with me. God says, all the peoples, think about this. Think about this word coming to little Jacob the grabber. All the peoples on earth will be blessed through you and your offspring. I am with you and will watch over you wherever you go. Wherever you are, the most ordinary place could be extraordinary. Not because you're doing something extraordinary, but because God would be with you. And he invites Jacob into a life where he could be always confident, into this quadrant of flourishing, where he could live with all the authority of being an image bearer of God and all the vulnerability of a dependent, finite, sinful little human being. That's where it becomes possible to live with genuine confidence. Such an interesting word. That word, confidence. Fi comes from the Latin, semper fi. Always faithful. One of the guys in our church who's a Marine was telling me after one of the services that semper fi, always faithful. And he said another phrase is semper gumby. Have you ever heard that one? Semper gumby, always flexible. Anyway, never mind. Feel vulnerable. Feel naked again. Confidence, to place confidence in God. Because what matters is not how much confidence you have. What matters is what are you putting your confidence in. I was playing a tennis tournament with my dad years ago. We were playing doubles, and we ended up playing against a team that was way better than us. These guys had actually played in Wimbledon, and I knew they were going to kill us. We're playing a couple games in, and my dad calls me over. He's serving. He says, John, I don't know what the outcome of this match is going to be, but I know this. You got to believe. You got to have confidence, or nothing good is going to happen if you don't actually have confidence. So my dad was serving the guy in the backhand court, and the guy would each time just hit a cross-court, kind of low shot. There's kind of an etiquette if you know your way better than the other guy, so he's doing that. And I decided my dad's right, so as soon as he went to hit his return, I took off and I poached and I banged a volley away for a winner, and I thought, I can do this. And I stood taller, which is a good thing, because the next time my dad served to this guy, he hit a return as hard as I have ever seen a ball hit in my life, and it was directly at me. It was about 1 inch above the net with tremendous topspin, and it actually went between my legs. And I said to my dad, I don't need more confidence. I need the angel of the living God if I'm going to stand at the net while you're hitting serves like this. Because here's the thing. It doesn't matter how much confidence you have if you have massive incompetence. Here's the thing. It's better to have a little confidence in the right object than massive confidence in the wrong object. Better to have a little confidence in God than massive confidence in yourself. And that's what Paul is writing about, see. Because yourself's going to be in trouble one day. Yourself's going to take on an enemy that yourself cannot handle. And that's the enemies Paul's talking about when he talks about being always confident. This is the verse. Paul says, therefore, we're always confident. And know that as long as we're at home in the body, we're away from the Lord. We are confident. That word again, I say. And would prefer to be away from the body and at home with the Lord. And so Paul, who's no Tom Brady, Paul says, when the ultimate enemy, when death comes, I will be confident because my confidence is not in myself. Because I'll tell you something about yourself, Bay Area. No matter how magnificent yourself looks, no matter how educated yourself might be, no matter what kind of great connections yourself has piled up, no matter how impressive a resume yourself has written, the day is going to come when yourself is going to be old and wrinkled and feeble and frail, and death is going to come on, and yourself is not going to beat death. I don't care where yourself has been or how strong it's looked. Doesn't matter how connected you are, how bright you are, how smart you are, how pretty you are. Doesn't matter if you were Tom Brady or Tom Cruise or Tom Selleck or Tom Hanks or Tom Brokaw or Thomas Jefferson or Thomas Edison or Thomas Paine or Tom Thumb. Doesn't matter what kind of Tom you were. Okay? Our confidence is not in anything that ourself has done. Our confidence is this: our God is able. Our God is able to roll away stones. Our God is able to forgive sinners. Our God is able to give grace. Our God is able to replace despair with hope. Our God is able to make weak hands strong. Our God is able to make the lame leap for joy. Our God is able to bring light into darkness. Our God is able to do immeasurably more than all you can ask or imagine. Imagine our confidence is in the God who is able. That's where our confidence is. And that's why Paul says, therefore, we are always confident. And that's what we're going to learn in this series, this tremendous adventure together. So when you leave today, at every site, there's this little card, always confident. And I invite you to pick one up and take it with you this week. Put it in your Bible or put it in your pocket or wallet or whatever. And this week, practice confidence in God. When I get up in the morning, my first thought gets to be, God, this is you and me facing this day together. So I'll look forward to it right now. When I'm with other people, look them right in the eye and be confident in God. God, I'll be confident that through you, there is some way that you're going to care for this person, some way that you're going to love this person. I don't have to worry about what am I saying or how's that coming across. This week, I won't compare myself to anybody, not even Esau. This week, I'll say what it is that I'm really thinking in great confidence and trust that God will work in that. This week, I won't obsess over my money. I won't worry about that. So interesting with Jacob. When he has this encounter with God, the response is, the last thing he says is, God, I'm going to tithe everything I have. Why? Because I trust now, God, that you're watching out for me. So Jacob the grabber becomes Jacob the giver. This week, when you go to school, when you go to work, instead of worrying about all the problems and all the stuff that you haven't figured out, I will be confident that it's not just me, it's me and God together, and we can do this. Always confident. And then one more word about the difference between self-confidence and God-confidence. And then come back next week. Kind of a surprise next week. You will want not to miss next week. But I got to say this one more word about why God-confidence is so different. Because we live in a society where self-confidence can be very much an individualistic thing. And people think it's just about me and enhancing my life. Kind of a self-help thing. What God says to Jacob is very interesting. Is, I will bless you, but it's not about just you getting blessed. And all the peoples on the earth will be blessed through you. Jacob, you, little Jacob, you little grabber, you little deceiver, you're going to be a part of what I'm doing so that the whole world, the most vulnerable, can flourish. I met a guy a couple weeks ago. I wish you all could have met him. His name is Doug Mazza. He's an amazing man. Humanly speaking, a lot of authority. He's the top exec in America in Suzuki, and then he was tapped to be the head of the American division of Hyundai. A lot of connections, a lot of brains, a lot of ability. He's also a dad, and he had a son born named Ryan. Ryan was born with profound disabilities. Ryan was born with a skull that was misfused, so his brain, as it began to grow, actually grew out of his eye sockets, actually pushed his eyes out of their sockets. Couldn't see, couldn't speak, couldn't walk. Wouldn't last a moment taking care of himself. Profoundly vulnerable. No authority. Except his dad found his life and heart strangely touched, strangely ennobled by caring for this son who would realize none of the dreams that most dads have for most sons. And Ryan's vulnerability transformed Doug's heart. And he ended up going to work for, taking a leadership role with a ministry called Johnny and Sons, who seek to extend the love of God to the over 600 million people with profound disabilities all around the world, who so often are forgotten, who so often are ignored, who so often are relegated to the margins. Because we serve a Jesus who came to earth with great authority, but who said, whatever you do for the least of these, for the naked, for the blind, for the alone, for the imprisoned, for the impoverished, for the most vulnerable, whatever you do for these, you do for me. Doug said that he considers himself now to be Ryan's junior partner. He considers himself to be the junior partner. Because Doug has blessed Ryan with his authority, but Ryan has blessed Doug with his profound vulnerability. And do you see, this is not about self-confidence. It's not about smart, strong people living smart, strong lives. Where authority and vulnerability dance together, there's Jesus. There is the kingdom of God. Doug says that he doesn't know what all is able to go on in Ryan's mind, but he will often read to his son Ryan about Jesus from the Gospels, and when he does, Ryan smiles. Always confident. Would you pray with me? And I want to invite you now, wherever you might feel vulnerable, wherever you might feel hurt, wherever you might feel disappointed, wish I was somebody else, tempted to compare myself to somebody else, not loved. God is saying to you right now, I will be with you where you are, who you are, what you've done, where you've been. I will love you. I will watch over you. Bring all your vulnerability to God. And I want to sing, there's an old song, probably none of you will know it, but I kind of grew up with it. Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so. There's this line in it, little ones to him belong. They're weak. He's strong. And when we get to that line, see, we're the little ones, you and me. You're the little one. You're the little one. I'm the little one. He's the strong one. Always confident.